The German spy chief has told the BBC that the far-right Alternative for Deutschland party poses a risk to the roots of democracy. The AfD regularly rejects accusations of extremism, but the BBC has found clear links between significant party figures and extremists or even former neo-Nazi networks.
The National Rally Party led by Marine Le Pen is on course to win a record 32% of the vote in the elections for the European Parliament. That is more than double the coalition which supports President Macron.
In the recent European elections, the far right won unprecedented gains. From the success of the AfD in Germany to Le Pen's national rally in France, the election saw nationalist and Eurosceptic parties sweep up nearly a quarter of the seats in the European Parliament. In the UK, voters will be heading to the polls against a backdrop of decades of economic failure, crumbling public services, and a cost of living crisis that has left more than 4 in 10 households unable to afford life's essentials. But you wouldn't know it from the way a lot of our political leaders are talking. Voters are being told yet again that times are tough, government spending power is weak, and there is no magic money tree. Oh, and of course, it really is time to crack down on migration once and for all.
Stopping the boats is a key Rishi Sunak pledge. And in Dover last week, he said his plans are having an impact.
For the first time, numbers are down. So this year, January to May, the numbers crossing are down by 20%.
But just this morning, the Home Secretary acknowledged the challenges.
The numbers keep rising because the boats keep coming.
So, how can we understand the promises, or lack thereof, of the people vying for our votes within a broader context of political upheaval across Europe? In a time of such great need, why are Labour and the Conservatives offering so little? And as the dust settles on the European elections, is the UK really an anomalous country leaning to the left, while our continental neighbours lurch rightward? Welcome to the New Economics Podcast. This week, we're asking, how do we build a pan-European progressive movement that can win? I'm Aisha Thomas-Smith. Stay with us. So, this week, I'm delighted to be joined by Yanis Varoufakis, economist, academic, formerly Greece's finance minister, and author of a number of critical books, the latest of which is Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism. Hi, Yanis.
Hello, it's very good to be here.
Thank you so much for being with us. So, as I mentioned at the top of the episode, in the European elections, while of course people still overwhelmingly voted for centrist parties, we did see significant gains for radical and ultra-right parties. With many progressive parties, including your own Mirror 25, faring arguably worse than predicted. So how can we understand these results and how should progressives be responding?
There's the dominant paradigm or narrative that this is a clash between the centre, which is more or less holding, and the ultra-right, which is on the ascendancy, but not there yet. Mm. And that these two are two different worlds clashing mercilessly against one another. This is the dominant story. Mm. It's not my story. My story is that the two, the radical center and the radical right, the neo-fascistic, xenophobic right, let's not call them nationalists, they're fascists, they are symbiotic. Macron would never be president if Le Pen was not fascistic and strong. Mm. And Le Pen would never be strong if somebody like Macron was not introducing policies year after year after year, not just Macron, but somebody like Macron from a radical center that combined austerity for the masses and socialism for the financiers. This is what has been happening since the great financial collapse of 2008. The left versus right narrative of the media, where Starmer is presented as a lefty and Sunak a rightist, that's completely, how shall I put it politely, besides the point, let me be blunt. Starmer is not left of Sunak, and Sunak is not right of Starmer. If you look even at the manifestos, the Tory manifesto and the Labour manifesto are so close. It's mind-numbing how close they are in reality. They are proposing to do nothing to cap the super profits of the City of London, to do anything about capital gains, to create a New Deal-like investment spree to invest in good quality jobs, in green transition, green energy. All that is conspicuous by its absence from both manifesto. And in exactly the same way as in continental Europe, what I very much fear is going to unfold in Britain now is that the radical centre, it doesn't matter whether it's represented by Starmer or Sunak, is going to win this election, raise high hopes and expectations in the same way that Macron did in France or Scholz did in Germany or Sarkozy did a long time ago in France, and then frustrate them. And the discontent that's going to emerge from this frustration is going to be harvested by toxic alliance between the worst parts of the Tory party, who are prepared to ditch the conservative legacy, the one nation legacy, the slightly more civilized aspect of Tory rule in the past, and going to bed with fascists of Nigel Farage, the remnants of the BNP, and so on. And that will put Britain back into the European Union, not formally, but to all intents and purposes.
I have a lot of thoughts on what you just said, but I want to stick with Europe for a second. And it would be really great if you could help us understand what's happening there in terms of this arguable lurch to the right, especially among young people who we're seeing kind of voting for the far right in their droves. Is there something kind of specific that's happening that's a pattern across Europe that you can point to and say, this is why folks are moving in this direction? And as you say, we can see this, we can expect the same in 5 to 10 years, or is it myriad factors that we're oversimplifying?
I'm going to speak as an economist for a moment, if you allow me, but this is the New Economics Foundation, so I think I'm allowed. In 1971, we had the end of the first post-war era, the Bretton Woods system, which was a very tightly planned, centrally planned capitalist system with fixed exchange rates, more or less standard given interest rates of around 4%, capital controls, boring banking, industrial capital leading, with social democratic elements taking parts of the pie of the profits of the industrialism, giving it to the NHS, giving it to workers, better wages and conditions. That died with the death of the Bretton Woods system. And then you have a second period, which is an astonishing period in human history, in the sense that this was the very first time that we have a hegemonic power, the United States, an empire, which is getting stronger and more hegemonic the more into the red it goes. That has never happened before with any empire, any country, any entity. How did they succeed in doing that? Essentially, the United States economy was like a vacuum cleaner sucking into its territory the excess or net exports of Germany, of France, of Italy, of Japan, and later China. And how was it paying for them? By getting the capitalists of Germany, of France, of Italy, of Japan, and China to send their profits to Wall Street for recycling. That was the foundation of the European Union, and in particular the Eurozone. So as long as that recycling, very perverse recycling mechanism, functioned, Europe could create its common currency, it could create its single market, it would pretend that it was integrating. Then 2008 ended all that. This was when the bottom fell out of the City of London, but of course Wall Street, and then all the banks in Germany and France, every single one of them went bankrupt. Then immediately, in a state of panic, Europe's leaders embarked upon a very interesting experiment, bailing out the bankers, socialism for the bankers, and universal massive austerity, far, far worse than George Osborne's in this country, across the continent of Europe. Greece was the lab in which it was practiced and it was honed, and then it was taken to Italy, to France, and to Germany. 20 years of this, 15, 20 years of this, zero investment. Because if you're an industrialist in Germany, and you look out of your window in Frankfurt or in Stuttgart, wherever, and you see impecunious masses, and the central bank sends billions to you, you're not going to invest that money. You're going to take it and buy back your own shares, which drives share prices up, stock exchanges up, real estate prices up, asset inflation up, increases inequality, creates discontent. So we've had 20 years of discontent. Now, especially after the pandemic, because of 20 years of zero investment, net investment has been zero in Germany, a country that was swimming with surpluses unlike Britain, right? Now the German business model, German industry is kaput, finished. They have no capacity now to compete with the Chinese or the Americans, who have not been practicing universal austerity in the same way. That is the background. So the center, center left, center right, which has been representing this policy, now has no capacity to impress not just the young people, but anyone. The failure of us, and by us I mean the radical left, especially the failure of the Greek radical left, because we were the locus of a kind of spring, a European spring, a Greek spring. All eyes were on us in 2015, from Spain, from even from Britain, from Germany, from France, and we betrayed that. When in the name of the radical left you have the same old centrist, radical center austerity policies being introduced, then the radical left loses its capacity to impress anyone. So you have all this discontent, which is a result of this economic and political failure. Somebody has to harvest it. Just as in the mid-war period, it's a fascist who do. This is why you end up now, in a few weeks, in France, according to opinion polls, for every one youngster who will vote for the left, two or three youngsters will vote for the fascists. This is a postmodern version of the 1930s for the same reasons that we had in the 1930s. Wall Street collapsed and European capitalism failed to generate demand and investment. And when the discontent was not harvested by the left, it was harvested by the fascists, the xenophobes, the racists. This is a repeat performance.
But why isn't it harvested by the left? And what are the kind of narratives or stories that are being told by the far right that are winning young people over in their droves? Because I think that's a piece that seems to be missing for me. You know, we've seen the surge of Reform UK here to an extent. They've arguably just taken over Tories in some polls. And the question I'm left with is, why aren't the left sweeping up those discontented voters and stepping in?
OK, well, allow me to answer it in two parts. First, The fascists do not need a sophisticated narrative. That is the whole point of the fascists. All the fascists need to do is to say three things. I will look after you. And take note that they do when they are in power. When Mussolini got into power, he introduced pensions. When Viktor Orban took over in Hungary, he trebled the minimum wage. I have no doubt that if Le Pen takes power, she will do something similar. So I look after you as long as you have no voice. No trade unions are allowed. I will have absolute authority and I will crush you if you dare speak out. But I will look after you in terms of crumbs off the table of the rich. The second point is, let's all unite against the other. And third, let's make Germany, Greece, France, Britain, America great again. That's all you need if you're a fascist. Right, and then once you get power, then you go into bed with the worst of the oligarchs. Think of Trump; he was going to drain the swamp, which was Wall Street. And the first thing he does is he appoints the CEO of Goldman Sachs as his treasury secretary. But this is what the Nazis did when they got into power in Germany. Immediately, they went into bed with Krupp and the industrialists that they were lambasting as they were beating people into submission to get into power. So that's the right. Regarding the left, well, look, the left, we have been divided from the beginning. Remember Monty Python, you know, the scene, the Judean People's Front versus the Liberation Front of Judea. We have this thing. But allow me just to say that there are three parts of the left. The communist left never recovered from the collapse of communism. Even when they held strongholds, like in Greece, the Communist Party, they've been doing this by essentially taking their leave from reality and from society and simply creating a little haven where people can huddle like sheep in a storm and try to pretend that the world is not going the way it is going. Then you have the Social Democrats. Now, one might have thought back in 1991 that it would be a golden era for the Social Democrats because they never sided with the Soviet Union, but that didn't happen because as power was shifting from industry to finance, the old traditions of a Harold Wilson, of a Willy Brandt, of social democratic prime ministers who sat down with captains of industry on one side of the table and trade unions on the other and cutting a deal between them. They could no longer do that because industry was losing its capacity to command wealth. That capacity was shifting to bankers. So how do you put together Goldman Sachs people, you know, Lloyds Bank, CEOs with trade unions? What are they going to discuss? It's impossible to do it. So instead you have Tony Blair and you have François Mitterrand and you have Gerhard Schröder in Germany, Social Democrats, who say they cut a Faustian bargain with the bankers to say, look, we will allow you to do whatever you want, deregulate, do your worst, as long as you give us a certain percentage, small percentage of your huge profits, which is a lot of money, small percentage of huge profits, banking profits, for the NHS. Tony Blair spent a lot of money on the NHS by taking crumbs off the city's table. But then, in 2008, it all collapses. Wall Street, the city collapses. And at that time, when you needed some social democracy in government to say to the bankers, you know what, I'm going to save the bank because it is the arteries of the system and so on, but I'm not going to save you. You're going to hell. I'm going to nationalize the banks like the South Koreans did in 1998 or the Swedes did in 1992. They didn't do that because the Labour Party here, the SPD in Germany, they were in the pockets of the bankers. They were bankrolling their campaigns. And also, I don't think that the Social Democrats under Blair and so on had the analytical capacity to understand what the hell is going on. They believed in the rhetoric that it was riskless risk what was going on before 2008. So that's why social democracy died. Because, you know, when social democracy introduces austerity against the people that it's supposed to serve, well, that's a great gift to the right. As for us, the radical left, well, this I'm going to take to my grave, the great regret that we missed that opportunity, because we had a great opportunity in 2015. If we continued the struggle, if we simply said, continue to say no, and if we had to issue our own currency, issue our own currency. Because, you see, the Spaniards were watching. Podemos were on the rise. The Germans were watching. Die Linke was on the rise. The French were watching. If we had succeeded, if we had stuck to our guns, if we had remained conviction radical leftists, then I believe Europe would have been a very different place now. But we caved in. Immediately, Podemos were destroyed by us. We destroyed Podemos. And then that created a chain reaction across Europe, which had an impact here as well, in the end. So we leftists failed to harvest the discontent caused by this particular 30-year, 20-year-long crisis of capitalism. And again, as in the mid-war period, it is the fascists who are benefiting.
Hopefully it doesn't have to remain that way. Perhaps I'm being overly optimistic, but we'll come back to this. We'll come back to kind of where things might move to, because arguably, you know, some folks might say that Labour is currently playing a particularly safe, shrewd political game, that they're trying to get into government. And when they do, they'll kind of realise that there isn't necessarily the economic ideas lying around that they need to solve the issues that we've been talking about thus far. And therefore, while they've made it their kind of mission to ostracize, or at least to be seen to ostracize, the radical left as much as possible in this country, they will in fact need some of them, some of us, and the ideas that we put forward, if they're actually going to achieve any of the things that they want to achieve and not just be ousted in the next election and we end up with a Farage prime minister. So, you know, there's a world in which that's possible, and I want to come back to that world, but let's dive a little bit deeper on the UK context for now. I think there are probably some listeners who might disagree with your analysis of the Labour and Conservatives being two sides of the same coin. People might argue, for example, that Labour are much more progressive on, say, certain climate initiatives. They've got GB Energy.
That is all irrelevant.
Interesting. Hold that thought for one second.
They are not going to put any money into it.
Yeah, perhaps.
Smoke and mirrors again.
Yeah, there's also Sunak's, you know, Rwanda scheme, even though Labour are saying they're also going to be hard on migration, the attitudes to Brexit. There's the fact Labour has arguably this new deal for workers in comparison to steamrolling workers' rights quite proudly on the Conservative side. There are some distinctions to be made. Perhaps. I think that one thing that is probably undeniable is that Labour is pursuing currently an agenda of social liberalism and fiscal conservatism in a country which broadly, historically, has always lent towards being socially conservative and fiscally liberal. Now, that's a gamble that some people say might well pay off. However, other people argue that what that's going to lead to is, while they're promising that there's not going to be a return to austerity, they're going to have no choice but to pursue an austerity agenda when their grand plan to harness investment and enact economic growth in order to invest in public services falls flat, essentially. So what are your predictions based on how you can see things at the moment in a UK context? Say Labour win the election, say they have a really healthy majority. Based on what you see them saying now, what do you think is going to happen over the next 5 years in economic terms? And where do you think we're going to be in 2029?
If a miracle happens along the lines of your description, I'll be very happy. But I'd feelings foolhardy and rather aggressive to bank on miracles. And I also think that it is disrespectful to Keir Starmer and his team not to take seriously their manifesto. I read manifestos. I'm a nerd. They're, what you might say is that they are promising to do things which they are not going to follow through on. That is a very real worry that we should always have when we read a manifesto. But my concern is that their great intentions are wrong. I mean, when I read their manifesto and I see the costings they have put forward, the austerity is baked in the manifesto. It's not that they may have to do austerity. They are telling us they are going to do austerity. They are proclaiming it. If you look at the tiny, minuscule little extra revenues that they are applying, you know, VAT on private schools and a couple of other small things, that's about $7 billion. But you have Rachel Reeves. I never expected her to come, to go out and, you know, with a photo of Marx and Lenin, proclaim the revolution. But at the same time, when she comes out and she rules out during the election campaign, nobody asked her that question. It's so that she was responding to some aggressive questioning by a Rupert Murdoch journal. She comes out and tells the bankers, I am not going to cap the interest rates you get from the Treasury. This is a choice that she makes. Most people don't know what that means. Tiering of, you know, interest paid on the reserves that the banks have, the private banks with the Bank of England. She comes out and states it. So it's clear that she wants to proclaim her commitment to preserving the unearned privileges of the bankers against the interests of the Treasury. That needs to be judged on face value. Now, you may say that she may have a road to Damascus conversion after she becomes chancellor. Okay, maybe. But I don't think that it is sensible to discuss this. When you, there's nothing about capital gains, equalizing the capital gains rate to income tax rates. When you look at this budget, you can see, and the Institute for Fiscal Studies confirms that, if you look at all the commitments that are not already protected for, you know, public spending, for social benefits and so on, they will have, according to their own plans, to introduce tax of anything between 1.9 and 3.5%. So the austerity is there. It is part of their plan. It's not something they may resort to. You mentioned GB Power.
Yeah, GB Energy.
It's a scandal. What is the point of creating one more producer of electricity when the problem is that you have a pretend fake market, which you should never have had? Because let's face it, there can never be an electricity market. In this building, in your home, there is one cable coming out. You don't have 50 to choose from, which is the best electricity, the cheapest. There's one. So there is this a natural monopoly. The so-called market is a quasi-pretend market, which is essentially a cartel run by those businesses. The progressive thing to do is to essentially scrap this, take electricity generation under public ownership, and ensure that the achievements already made in Britain, because, you know, unlike my country, unlike Germany, unlike Italy, you're self-sufficient when it comes to electricity. You know, more or less, there are some bad days, but more or less, on the average day of an average month, Britain does not import energy for your electricity generation. You have more than 50%, more often than not, from wind power, even when it's not very windy, right? You've got your own sources of gas, of nuclear, and so on. Mm. So why are you paying an arm and a leg when the price of Texan LNG goes up? Why? Because of this pretend market. So if they wanted to do something to stop super profits for oligarchs owning your electricity grid and your electricity power station, the solution is not to spend a lot of money to produce yet another one. The solution is to end this fake market. But that takes some guts to do.
Yes, exactly. And the argument I'm sure that they would propose in response is coming out swinging with a policy like that is not going to win us the election because we want to be seen. This is not my argument, by the way. This is theirs. Yes. Because we want to be seen as economically competent within this very narrow Overton window that we have established for ourselves. And therefore, this is the first step in a longer and a much longer term strategy to start to bring onto the radar the idea of public ownership and what that might look like and make it look less scary and then build from there. What they might also say in response to some of these charges is, we're going to get growth. And once the economy is growing, well, I mean, that's the thing that's not necessarily in there, but they're going to get it, apparently.
Things may fly, all sorts of miracles may take place.
Industrial strategy, invest in business, climate.
Industrial strategy without money.
But once they get the growth, Yanis, bear with me, then they're going to have all the money that they need to invest in public services, and they're not going to have to turn to austerity. And they've also not technically ruled out things like capital gains tax or whatever. They're just not explicitly saying it at the moment.
Well, allow me to make a more general point, which I think also the New Economics Foundation has to turn into a big campaign. Stop talking about fiscal responsibility and stop them from presenting democratic failures as economic problems. When somebody like Rachel Reeves speaks of fiscal, you say to them, let's introduce dental care to NHS. Oh, this is not fiscally responsible. When you say, let's look after people who, you know, really need social care at home, we can't afford it and we want to be fiscally responsible. Call them out. Because when it comes to creating, to building nuclear submarines that are completely and utterly useless and a clear and present danger to world peace and the defense of this country, when they go to the Treasury and say, you know, we want a few zillions for a few nuclear-powered submarines, the Treasury says, oh, if it is a priority, we can afford it. But the moment you start saying something about social care or dental care, suddenly the money is not there. So call them out. They are repackaging class war and failures of democracy as economic problems when they are not economic problems.
NEF had a campaign on fiscal rules a couple of years ago, which was essentially about this. It was the idea that you create a straitjacket for yourself, you write fiscal rules on the back, and then you wear it optionally. And actually, we need to just be taking off the thing and saying, this is the emperor's clothes, you know.
And remember that Rachel Reeves was the one who scandalously came out again with a worn-out and ridiculous analogy of the credit card, accusing the Treasury or, you know, the Chancellor of the Exchequer of having maxed out the credit card. I mean, that is that, you know, George Osborne is smarter than that. And George Osborne is one of the dullest and most idiotic people on earth.
This podcast's doing quite well, though. I think that, yes, the public credit card is definitely something which, you know, there's actually lots of complaints in with Ofcom about that at the moment, ironically, because it's being flagged as an impartiality issue, because the BBC and Ofcom have ruled that it's essentially not politically impartial to use that metaphor because it serves the right so much, which is very interesting.
But, you know, she knew what she was doing.
Yeah.
She was signalling.
Yeah, it was a signifier.
The road to austerity in a red Labour Party package.
So in a word, as we're short on time, your prediction for 5 years from now, I know it's not good to be in the habit of making predictions, but austerity, fascism?
For me, it's not a question of not wanting to predict. I don't think we have the right to predict. Because, you know, a meteorologist has an obligation to predict the weather. It's what they do for a living. But that's completely innocuous because the weather doesn't give a damn about the meteorologist's predictions. But when it comes to society, is there going to be a turn towards fascism? This is down to us. It's what we do as citizens, as human beings. So, no predictions. Let's get down to work to keep the feet on the fire of this incoming Starmer administration, to keep exposing that which they are not doing, which they should do, and that which they are doing, which they shouldn't do, and organizing in our communities, in our cities, across the United Kingdom, for the purpose of preventing a coalition between Suella Braverman's Tory rump and Nigel Farage from turning Britain into another France.
So the role of the left in the UK over the next 5 years, you see as essentially harnessing the discontent that you mentioned at the top of the episode, ensuring that the Labour Party is held to account and creating the foundations for more progressive economic policy, more progressive social policy in general, in order to avoid the lurch to the right that we've seen in Europe.
That's right. And engage with working class people who are being lured by Farage. Mm. Do not demonise them. Do not treat them like Hillary Clinton treated the blue-collar workers in America, calling them deplorables. Explain to them. I'll give you an example, which I often bring out because it really shaped me. During the Brexit campaign, I was in Doncaster at some point, and I was campaigning against Brexit from a left-wing perspective. And there was this old lady, very beautiful old lady, who came to me and said, look, Yanis, I'm not a racist. But, the usual sentence, right? But, she said, in my building, there are few people I can talk to because all the small apartments are taken over by Romanian boys, young men from Romania, who rent one room, four of them, and they save a lot of money as a result of this. They're all very nice boys, she said. She was actually quite nice about them. And, you know, I'm trying to be motherly towards them. But because they have all the spending power, four in one room, they bid up rents. And, you know, locals can't afford to live there anymore. And I said to her, tell me the story of your building. She said, oh, it used to be a council house. Council housing. And then it was sold off to privateers. I said, so the problem is not the Romanian boys so much. It is that that was sold off and no council houses have been built for the locals. She said, yeah. So once you start engaging in that context, pointing out the discontent, their diminished life prospects are due to austerity. They're not due to the Romanian boys. If you simply were to extract the Romanian boys and send them back to Romania, what will happen? Doncaster would be even sadder and poorer. It wouldn't be a better place. Maybe rents would go down, but everything else would go down as well. So this is the kind of engagement we need to focus on.
It's interesting. I often tell a similar story of when I was organising embarking in Dagenham a couple of years ago. Mm. And a lot of folks that I met with there said, you know, there's a massive problem here with immigration. When you drill down into it, I asked for examples. They would say, my daughter's been on the council housing list for, 10 years. Again, migrants are getting them instead. We have a similar conversation. Or they say, in my son's school, we've been told that you can either have a new maths teacher so that you would be able to have reasonable class sizes, of less than 30, or we can have teaching assistants for the Lithuanian children who don't speak English. And they go in the direction of the teaching assistants for Lithuanians. And there the conversation is, well, as you say, is that really about the Lithuanian teaching assistant, or is that about there not being enough funding for the schools to have good maths class sizes in the first place? You know, it's not a complicated conversation to have, but I don't think that the left, whether it's here or in Europe, is very good at engaging with that because, as you said, they're scared of the idea of meeting people where they are.
We must not surrender the working class to the fascists by antagonizing them. We've got to listen to them and we have to engage with them.
I want to ask a quick question about climate policy specifically. This is a little personal bugbear of mine, but it seems like that there's a pattern across Europe and it's happening here in the UK at the moment with Starmer as well. You have a so-called progressive saying climate is my thing, right? This is the hill I'm going to die on. I'm going to be really progressive on climate. Then, of course, the way they actually enact those policies is deeply unequal, for example, with the Gilets Jaunes in France. And then the right is able to mobilise it into a culture wars issue. We had the same thing here with the ULEZ, for example. So how do we pursue climate policies and a radical climate agenda in the face of that dialectic that happens again and again? It becomes a culture wars issue and then it enthuses the fascists. When mostly what's happening, and it's happening here in the UK as well, is the response to that is to turn up the dial on migration, essentially, and saying, I'm going to come down harder on that, and that's how I'm essentially going to appeal to and appease the far right in what they're saying around the culture wars. We obviously know that climate and migration are so deeply interlinked as issues. They're only going to move further up the agenda. And for me, that's something that we really need to address now.
Serious question. The real question, the trillion-dollar question, is who pays for the green transition? You mentioned the Gilets Jaunes in France. That was a very good example where Macron, being Macron, after having cut corporate taxes and cut taxes on wealth taxes on the rich, he said, okay, now I have to do something about the environment, so I'm going to increase the price of diesel because diesel is bad for the environment. And then suddenly people who relied on 15-year-old diesel cars and couldn't take their kids to school or drive themselves to work or drive their tractors effectively rose up. And if they were not left-wing, they fell into the trap of the culture wars of the right in exactly the way you said it. So the question is, who pays for this? So one thing, for instance, you could argue for and campaign for is a neutral carbon tax, where we all pay a tax in proportion to the damage that we do to the atmosphere. That tax is neutral in the sense that it goes into a kitty, and then it's redistributed to the poorer. So the poorer have a capacity to buy an electric car, for instance, right? Massively redistributive carbon tax. More generally, we need to make the point that you cannot be an ecologist, you cannot be a greenie, unless you are a radical leftist as well. Because what is destroying the environment as we speak is the fact that huge profits can be made out of not paying for the damage on the environment committed by those who are accumulating capital. through the fossil fuel industry, through ridiculous pharaonic projects that essentially are increasing our footprint. So oligarchy is the worst enemy of the environment, of the planet. You cannot be a greenie and turn a blind eye to the exorbitant power of the oligarchs.
Well, I mean, this is where we run into issues with the Labour growth agenda, right? You can't have infinite growth on a finite planet, as we know. There's a word for that in biology, and it's cancer.
But the only good thing is that there will be no growth coming out of this Labour manifesto, so...
You said it. We are going to have to wrap up in a second, although I have lots more I'd like to ask you about. But I would be remiss if we didn't touch on your wonderful new book, Technofeudalism. It might seem like a shoehorn, but I'm about to link it. We are currently operating within a context of shifting economic paradigms. We all know this. And in the last episode of the podcast, we interviewed George Monbiot, and we were talking about the genealogy of neoliberalism and kind of some of the stories that we need to tell in this new paradigmatic moment to move beyond it. In your new book, Technofeudalism, you talk about the end of capitalism and this new epoch that we're in that has replaced it. I'd love you to briefly explain the concept behind the book and how it is relevant to what we've been talking about in this episode in terms of being on completely new ground when it comes to the battle we're fighting.
This book has annoyed many of my friends on the left, especially the Marxist left, because they say, but Yanis, if capitalism has died and we don't have socialism, how can that be, you know, our job in this world? We came to this planet to replace capitalism with socialism, and you're saying that we've got something worse now.
We've missed the boat.
Yeah. And say, yes, we have. Let's admit it and do something about it. But anyway, the basic premise is this. In the same way that we had a great transformation 250 years ago from feudalism to capitalism, when power shifted from those who owned land to those who owned capital, machines, and wealth as a result of that great transformation started accumulating not to those who collected rents, but to those who collected profits out of their capital goods, their produced means of production, their steam engines, their railway systems, and so on. In the same way, I'm arguing, we are now undergoing another great transformation from a world where traditional capital, machinery, was the source of profits and therefore power, to one where we have a new form of capital, a mutation of capital, machinery again, except that they are not primed, they are not created to produce things, they are created to modify our behavior. This is the algorithmic capital, I call it cloud capital, that lives in your phone, on your laptop, and so on. If I'm right in this, for instance, when I say that the moment you enter a digital platform, whether it is Alibaba or Amazon or Uber or Airbnb or any of these digital platforms, you've exited capitalism. This is not capitalism anymore, because that platform is ruled by one algorithm. There's no decentralization. There are no buyers and sellers that have any degree of capacity to communicate with another, to discuss with them. Everything is mediated through the algorithm. It belongs to one person or a small cabal of people, shareholders, and they can do amazing things. They can use this cloud capitalist algorithm to train us, to give us good advice so that they can then impress upon us desires that are functional to the owners of that cloud capital for us to have, which then those desires that it had forged in our bosom, in our heart and soul, they satiate by bypassing every market, selling us that stuff directly using the same algorithm which runs the warehouse workers as automata, as in the Charlie Chaplin movie Modern Times. And at the very same time, we replenish and accumulate that capital for them with all the activities that we do, like posting views and videos and chats and so on. In the process, we have traditional proletarians who are producing all the surplus value. We have what I call cloud serfs. You and me, when we use Google Maps, we add to the capital stock, the cloud capital stock of Google, unwaged labor, producing capital for the first time in history, the history of humanity. And then, of course, finally, these cloud thieves and the cloud capital owners, they extract whatever surplus value is retained by traditional capitalists, whom I call vassal capitalists, and that money exits the circular flow of income, making the macroeconomic crisis of this system we live in, which I call technofeudalism, even greater than we had under capitalism. It also feeds into geopolitical tensions between the real owners of cloud capital, who are the Americans in Silicon Valley and the Chinese on the western coast of China. So this is my hypothesis. My hypothesis is that if we care about the stability of a world which is off its rocker, and if we care about the exploitation both of proletarians and the precariat, people who are now working so hard without even receiving a wage at all, whom I call cloud serfs, we need to take very seriously, but also optimistically and hopefully, this news that we are living in a time of a great transformation, which creates very powerful forms of cloud capital that we can use ourselves in order to overthrow techno-feudalism in the same way that the left had always planned to use capital goods to take control of them and turn them into instruments that will serve the interests of the many, not the few.
And so practically, is the solution that, are some of the solutions more traditional regulation? Is it breaking up, you know, say, Google into smaller companies? Like, what are we talking about? No, completely wrong. What is it?
What good would it do to break up Google? I mean, how can you break up Twitter? Yeah. I mean, the whole point is that you want to tweet to everybody in the world, so you don't want to break it off. No. I'm a traditional Marxist. The solution is to take over the algos. So imagine, instead of having Uber, having a cooperative of drivers with their algorithm, which allows them to serve you and allows the community better access to taxi drivers who are not being destroyed by the algorithm. So take over the algorithm as part of cooperatives, as part of one person, one vote. So the socialist agenda remains, but we need to adapt it to a new world shaped by a mutation of capital, which I call cloud capital. Mm.
The new means of production. I mean, I really liked when you spoke about this on another podcast recently. You said that you personally love Spotify and the recommendations that they give to you, and they're all great. But the worst kind of...
This is why I'm so worried.
Yeah, because the worst kind of slavery is the one you choose for yourself.
That's right, the one you consent to.
Yeah, which reminded me of the much quoted Thatcher truism that economics is the method, the object is to change the soul.
Indeed.
That is unfortunately all we have time for on this episode, although there's lots more things I would like to ask you about. But thank you so much for being with us, Jan.
Barifakis. It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
If people want to find out more about what you're currently up to, how can they get more Yanis?
Well, yanisvarifakis.eu.
Oh, simple. There we go. That's how you can do it, lovely listener. That is it for today's New Economics podcast and also for this series, SOB. But we will be back soon with more episodes. If you have enjoyed this episode, please tell someone about it. To become a NEF supporter, you can visit neweconomics.org. The New Economics podcast is brought to you by the New Economics Foundation, produced by Amy Clancy, James Rush and Margaret Welsh. I'm still Aisha Thomas-Smith. See you next time.